Next week, the Commerce Department releases its estimates of how the U.S. economy did in the third quarter of this year. Economists predict seeing a downturn in the United States. There's your sign of recession. And they say it will be felt around the world because that's globalization. The world economy is now so interconnected that countries go through recessions and recoveries together. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
6 months ago, it appeared the subprime mortgage crisis meant the United States was in for a period of economic distress. But at least one economist, Nouriel Roubini, was already on the record predicting an international crisis. His cover article in the March issue of Foreign Policy magazine was titled "The Coming Financial Pandemic." Speaking at Columbia University this week, Roubini said the economic data eventually showed he was right 6 months ago.
The numbers from the second quarter of this year suggested that not only the U.S. was entering a recession, but also the U.K. was entering a recession, that the rest of Europe was entering a recession, Japan was beginning to have an economic contraction, Canada was starting to have a recession.
Since then, it's only gotten worse.
People usually say when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches the cold. And this time around, the U.S. is not just going to sneeze. It's going to have a severe case of pneumonia or something more severe than that. And therefore, the transmission to other countries is going to be also very, very severe.
Indeed, it's the rate at which this economic crisis has been transmitted from the United States to the rest of the world that has most caught the attention of international economists.
The speed is phenomenal and frightening.
Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He points to one event in particular, the collapse of the Lehman Brothers investment bank on the weekend of September 14th.
And it was really the shock of the financial panic in the week of September 15 that ricocheted around the world nearly instantaneously that has made the worldwide contagion effect utterly dramatic.
Contagious diseases spread when people come into contact with each other. The financial crisis now sweeping the world could not have spread so quickly were it not for the many ways the economies of the world are now interconnected, much more so than at the time of the last major global recession 30 years ago. Jeffrey Sachs, who's also an economic advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, explains how it works.
The amount of trade as a share of national income, the financial flows as a share of just about anything, are much larger now than they were back in the 1970s. And this means that the piping of the international system connects the world's economies in more varied ways and certainly in more intense transmission linkages than would have been true 30 years ago.
U.S. banks got in trouble because they were holding mortgage securities that were worth a lot less than the banks initially thought they were. But it now turns out that many European banks had invested in those same mortgage securities. The boundaries between national economies are disappearing. This can be helpful. U.S. consumer spending boosts the companies in China that make the goods U.S. consumers buy. China, in turn, has more money to invest in the United States. This coupling can mean the effects of a downturn in any one country can be softened. Michael Moussa is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
When underlying forces are going in different directions, with the U.S. economy tending to slow and the rest of the world still pretty strong, it helps push us up. At the same time, it's slowing them down a little bit. When we're all slowing down together, though, then it's self-magnifying.
Self-magnifying, meaning a global downturn moves more quickly, spreads more widely, and goes deeper than it otherwise would. This is what's happening right now because of globalization. But there is a silver lining, says Michael Moussa.
For the same reason that going down together tends to magnify on the downside, coming up together tends to magnify on the upside.
Globalization, on the one hand, means recessions can be felt instantly around the world, but it should also mean that when a few key economies make a turning point toward recovery, those countries will quickly lift the rest of the world with them. Moussa thinks that global uptrend should happen sometime next year. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Economists disagree so frequently that President Harry Truman once said, "Give me a one-armed economist, That way, Truman reasoned, the economist would never be able to offer him advice and then say, on the other hand...
Truman might be more comfortable with economists now. There's a surprising level of agreement among people who normally agree on very little. Here's NPR's economics correspondent Adam Davidson.
When you cover the economy as a reporter, there's one part of the job that is always easy: finding economists who disagree. Let me give an example. Alan Blinder of Princeton and Glenn Hubbard of Columbia. Blinder proudly calls himself a Keynesian, says the government should play an active role in ensuring a healthy economy. Hubbard, not so much. He thinks the government should get out of the way. Blinder is fine with higher taxes. Hubbard hates them. And to my shock, the other day, I read an editorial in Bloomberg News that these two guys, two intellectual opposites, wrote together. Blinder says it didn't take much to write the thing.
I was totally gratified that as we drafted this thing up, the level of disagreement was essentially zero. I mean, it was really easy to come to closure quickly on the exact wording.
Blinder and Hubbard were criticizing the idea that the FDIC should insure all deposits, no matter how big, removing the cap that was recently raised to $250,000. But forget the specifics. I've always thought that Keynesians, people who, roughly speaking, see a bigger role for government, don't ever write editorials with libertarians. And Blinder says that is kind of true, and it was very true a while ago. The two sides used to fight viciously.
It was pretty fierce in parts of the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And at times it got kind of nasty, yeah.
I don't want to give the impression that the disagreements ended in the 80s. The nastiness might have tempered, and there was a growing consensus on a bunch of issues. But call around economics departments, and I've done this, and start asking about tax policy or the right size of the federal government, and you'll always find sharp and clear divisions. I certainly did, until this year.
When the mistakes of the government are gigantic, then it's easier for the economists to see these mistakes and to rally around a common idea.
That's Luigi Zingales of the University of Chicago, where Keynes's biggest foe in the 20th century, Milton Friedman, taught. It has become a temple of anti-Keynesian economics. He says this sudden flourishing of agreement is more a reflection of just how bad the economy is and how lousy some of the proposed solutions have been. Take Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's original bailout proposal. A clear majority of economists of all persuasions hated it. The more recent idea of directly injecting capital into banks, that found a lot more support. Peter Fisher, formerly of the Fed and of the Treasury Department, who now manages money for BlackRock, says economists agree because today's problems are intellectually pretty simple. It comes down to banks just not having enough money. That's not part of the big fundamental questions of economics. It's really about the grubby mechanics of the financial system.
When it comes down to some of these grubby mechanics, economists who've thought about them, even from different perspectives, political perspectives or ideological perspectives, there are these limited set of moves you can make once you've thought it through.
I should note that there certainly are disagreements, even about the grubby mechanics. Many economists don't share the consensus view. But there is one thing that I bet just about every single economist agrees on. This period of happy consensus will soon end. Next year, when Congress and the nation debate the future of regulation and the role of the government in a market economy, oh boy, those economic conferences are going to get nasty again. Adam Davidson, NPR News, New York.
In addition to explaining so many things for us on Morning Edition, Adam Davidson hosts NPR's daily Planet Money podcast, and you can find it at npr.org/money. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Ever since Congress authorized $700 billion to rescue the economy 3 weeks ago, some lawmakers have argued it does too much for the banks and too little for homeowners facing foreclosure. Yesterday, government officials handling the bailout told the Senate Banking Committee that more help for homeowners may be on the way. NPR's David Wilma has the story.
It's been anything but a smooth ride for the U.S. economy since the bailout became law. But at a Senate Banking Committee yesterday, Neel Kashkari, whom Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's put in charge of the bailout, tried putting the best face on a worrisome situation.
We have seen numerous signs of improvement in our markets and in the confidence of our financial institutions. While there have been recent positive developments, our markets remain fragile.
Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd, who was a leading proponent of the bailout, had qualified praise for the moves Kashkari's team has made so far.
Few of any doubt that those actions have forestalled the worst-case scenario of a complete seizure in the financial markets. Nevertheless, one cannot escape hard truths about these regulatory actions. They have largely addressed the symptoms of the credit crisis rather than its cause.
And the cause, Dodd said, is the ongoing unresolved crisis of homes being foreclosed at a rate of 81,000 last month alone and a million for the entire year. Dodd pointed to a nationwide poll showing a majority of Americans disapprove of the bailout's focus on the banking industry.
Doing more for homeowners is the one policy solution that a majority of those Americans said they support. If there were ever a time that demanded that we think anew, this is it.
Congress did set up a voluntary program in July aimed at rescuing troubled mortgages. The Treasury's Kashkari said banks and homeowners have responded to a certain extent.
The industry is now at a pace of around 200,000 workouts a month, which is a huge increase from where they were when we started. But we agree with you, it's not enough. We need to do more.
That was the same conclusion reached by another witness, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Director Sheila Bearer.
Everyone agrees that more needs to be done for homeowners. We need to prevent unnecessary foreclosures, and we need to modify loans at a much faster pace.
Bearer told the panel one big reason banks have been reluctant to rewrite the terms of many mortgages is that their borrowers can continue to be bad credit risks.
So once they modify the loan, what happens if the borrower still defaults on payments subsequently, and then they have to try to liquidate and the losses are greater. So I think that is one area where greater certainty could be provided would make the economic decision to modify a lot more powerful, if not irresistible.
And the way to provide greater certainty, Bear said, is to use some of the bailout money to give loan guarantees to those banks that revise the terms of mortgages. She noted that the bailout legislation actually has a provision in it that allows federal authorities to make such loan guarantees. And she said Treasury Secretary Paulson is also very committed to enabling such a systematic modification of troubled loans. But bailout administrator Kashkari was cautious when Pennsylvania Democrat Bob Casey asked him if he supported going ahead with such a program.
We are looking at it very closely and working with our colleagues around the administration to understand the plan, understand how it would be implemented, what effect we think it would have, and how it would interact with the other programs. And so it's something we're very seriously considering.
When will we know the results of your serious consideration?
It's hard to give a specific date, Senator.
Kashkari said he did not know if it would be days or weeks before a loan guarantee program could be implemented. But he added it's something Treasury is very focused on right now. Banking Chairman Dodd said he'd spoken earlier in the day with Treasury Secretary Paulson and came away with the impression that Paulson was indeed determined to get such a program up and running.
But I want you to go back, Mr. Assistant Secretary, and convey the reactions here about our determination to get this up is very important.
Dodd said he expected to have further legislation aimed at stemming foreclosures, either for the lame duck session following next month's election or for the new Congress that convenes in January. David Wellna, NPR News, The Capitol.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week in New York, talking to people about the financial crisis. Manhattan is packed with hugely expensive buildings that rise dozens of stories above street level. And a lot of the people who work in them, or live in them, depend on the financial sector, directly or indirectly. So what's the impact of the credit freeze on that peculiarly New York business, very high rise, very high stakes commercial real estate? We asked someone who covers the business to show us some projects that aren't flying so high these days, and she took us for a walk.
Metro, New Metro.
Well, here we are at the corner of 8th Avenue and 41st Street on Manhattan's West Side. We're right across the street from the Port Authority bus terminal. We're in the shadow of the new New York Times building, and I'm with Dana Rubenstein, who covers commercial real estate for the New York Observer. Right across the street from us is a work-in-progress building.
Correct. So this is called 11 Times Square. It's a $1.2 billion tower that's rising to, well, it's almost already risen to 40-something floors, and it has no tenants. It's totally empty.
Not that that news in any way slows work on the project. I mean, they're working on this thing.
Right, so they're working on it right now.
East of Hare, George, east of Hare. All right, that's good, that's good.
Can you tell us what your name is?
I'm Derek Dethlefson, and I'm a layout engineer.
We hear they've got no tenants lined up for this building.
I don't know.
And a unique story that we're looking at here at 11 Times Square?
Yeah, I mean, this is the largest on-spec building in New York City, and arguably it may well be one of the biggest disasters.
Where do we go next?
Next, we're going to the old New York Times building on 43rd Street.
Not the really old New York Times building on Times Square where the ball comes down on New Year's Eve. The next stop on our tour of Midtown Manhattan real estate is the building that the paper was housed in until late last year. It's on 43rd Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, and it's empty.
In all fairness, that space is empty because they are the building's undergoing a $175 million internal renovation. However, it doesn't look to be tenanted anytime soon.
It's about a 12-story building. Mm-hmm. And it's just off Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's lining up around the corner to get a suite of offices here?
No, as far as I know, no one has signed a lease, much like no one has signed a lease at 11 Times Square. You know, part of that is that a lot of extra space is coming on the market with the collapse of a lot of these financial firms. So when this building was bought, the idea was that there's such a scarcity of office space in New York City that people would be lining up around the corner to sign leases for this space. But it looks like there's a lot more competition in the market right now and much less demand for new and very expensive office space.
Well, Dana, so much for the Times Square area. Where do we go to next?
Next, we're going to the GM building, which is considered the most valuable building in New York City. It's at the southeast corner of Central Park.
If real estate is about location, 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 then we have arrived. The General Motors building rises 50 stories into the sky, looming down on what used to be the Plaza Hotel, it's now condos, and Bergdorf Goodman, the department store, and Central Park.
It's considered the most expensive, the best office tower in New York City. It is the trophy of the trophy towers.
It's the GM building. Although the logos all over it are for Apple and CBS. I didn't see any GM all over it.
Right, right. GM building is merely a name at this point. So the building in, I believe it was early 04, was bought by a guy named Harry Macklow for, I believe it was $1.4 billion, which was at the time the largest price ever paid for any building anywhere. But in the beginning of 07, he put the building up as collateral to purchase a group of seven other trophy towers in New York City. That deal soon got him to a lot of trouble with his creditors, and he ended up having to put the GM building on the block, in addition to turning over those seven trophy towers to his creditors. So the building proceeded to get sold after 6 months or so on the market, which was a very long time for a building like this to be on the market. And it ended up selling for under its market price. It was thought that it would get more than $3 billion. It ended up getting $2.8 billion.
Still a lot more than Mr. Macklow had paid for it.
Sure, but at the time, property values were increasing so rapidly, and people just had these extraordinary expectations for what this building could fetch. And those expectations were dashed.
But Dana, that's saying, oi, I only made 125% gain on my building in a few years.
Well, it's not only that the building sold under market, it's that Macklow ended up having to sell the building under duress.
You get the idea? You can make a billion in 3 years on a piece of New York real estate and be a symbol of folly. Steven Siegel, no relation, knows this business inside out. He is chairman of global brokerage for C.B. Richard Ellis. They don't own properties, but if you want to rent a mile of Manhattan office space, talk to him. How's business?
Business is interesting. It's a time like I've never seen. I've been at it for 40 years, and probably a time I couldn't have imagined in terms of what's happened to the investment banking world and the number of banks and the liquidity crisis. Candidly, it hasn't ground business to a halt. We still have activity. This is a very diverse city, a very resilient city, And there's still activity. If you look around, you can hear it and see it and feel it.
Well, we are standing inside Bryant Park. It's behind the big New York Public Library. And looking up around us, well, some of your properties are among these huge buildings rising up.
Yes, we're looking right across the street at the redeveloped Verizon headquarters building that was purchased by Equity Office, subsequently sold to Blackstone. And it was completely torn down to the steel and redeveloped. And basically, it's a new building.
It got green somewhere along the line.
It got green. And
literally, it's a green building.
It's green and green.
Is it fully leased? And are you confident that all of those tenants are going to weather the storm and still be tenants after another few months?
No, I'm certain that several are not going to move in. I've already made that announcement and placed space on the market that hasn't been built out yet because they wanted to reserve the capital expenditures that they were faced with by moving to new space.
Stephen Siegel says the credit freeze does two things to the Manhattan office space market. It puts some tenants out of business, but it also means that new projects will be slower to get off the ground, so both supply and demand are reduced. He takes comfort from knowing that there is a longer cycle than the ups and downs of business. He speaks of a quality of life cycle.
When things are good, when people want to live in a city, they want to work in a city, et cetera, that's something that goes on for 20, 25 years and would take several disasters to bring that down. And we're still in a good quality of life situation.
In the much shorter term, there's an eerie uncertainty in New York these days. Fortunes have been lost on paper. Storied investment houses have closed. But no one knows how hard the brunt of all this will ultimately be. And everyone wonders. In New York, this is Robert Siegel.